From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast, hosted by Paul Hanley.
For listening to this special edition of the China in the World podcast, which was recorded recently at our Carnegie office in Washington, D.C. In this special edition, I'm interviewed by my friend and Carnegie colleague, Tom Carver, Vice President for Communications and Strategy, as part of a new podcast series run out of our Washington, D.C. office entitled The Carnegie Podcast. I enjoyed having the opportunity to share with Tom my views on what to expect for U.S.-China relations in the new Trump administration.
Hello and welcome. I'm Tom Carver. So, China is a country on many people's minds at the moment. Obama once characterized the U.S. relationship with China as the most important relationship of the 21st century. But that doesn't seem to bother his successor that much, who's launched into a series of criticisms of China since winning the election. On January the 5th, he managed to take China to task over both North Korea and trade in a single tweet. China has been taking out massive amounts of money and wealth from the US in totally one-sided trade, the tweet said, but won't help with North Korea. Nice. Even before he was inaugurated, he announced that he had spoken directly with Taiwan's president, upending a long-standing US policy, and he ruffled a lot of China's feathers. In December, he told Chris Wallace on Fox, "I fully understand the one China policy, but I don't know why we have to be bound by it." So these sorts of direct assaults on some of the cornerstones of US-China relationship are unusual. But the question is it part of a negotiating plan to unsettle the Chinese? Or does President Trump really intend to take China up on these issues? Well, I'm very pleased to have with me here in the studio Paul Hanley, the director of our Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, who happens to be passing through D.C. for a few days. So, Paul, you worked in the National Security Council for both President Obama and President Bush on China issues. What do you think it would be like in there at the moment?
I'm actually here this week to try to sort of unearth some of the questions that you raise early on. What is Donald Trump's intention with respect to China? I think one of the things we have to do, though, is sort of step back for a second. Many of the things that Donald Trump is talking about, this sort of discussion about whether or not we have the right approach with China, are they doing enough on North Korea? Do we have the right trade and economic relationship? What are they doing in the South China Sea? And how much does that undermine our interest? These are issues that all predated Donald Trump even joining the presidential campaign. There was an emerging debate about whether we had the right framework with China and whether we needed to be tougher on some of these issues. And many of these are the issues that Donald Trump is bringing to the table. Now, what's different is the approach.
Right, the way he's bringing it to the table.
The tweets, the seemingly confrontational approach that he wants to take with China. And then, of course, what you've touched on, Tom, is this use of the One China policy as an effort to get leverage with the Chinese. And I think it's we should start with this.
Yeah.
Because
some of these things are more important than others, aren't
yeah.
they? But the One China policy is bedrock, right?
This is, I think, surprising to a lot of people. And his comment that you mentioned to Chris Wallace about indicating that he might adhere to it, but he might not. I think that represents some misunderstanding of what the One China policy is. The One China policy is not something that we adhere to because it's good for China. We've adhered to it because it's good for us, and it allows for a stable relationship with China and to maintain an unofficial relationship with Taiwan. Initially, in the early 70s, when we wanted to establish a relationship with the PRC, the People's Republic of China, in order to get leverage with the Soviet Union, we didn't want to abandon our friends on Taiwan. And so we had this ambiguous One China policy, which recognizes that China sees there's one China and that Taiwan is a part of that. But we don't accept China's definition of what that is. And so this ambiguity.
Just to unpack this so people might not understand. So the One China policy is a U.S. policy, not a China policy.
No, it's an agreement between, it's a concept, an agreement between the PRC and China that there is one China.
The PRC and U.S.
In the U.S., that there is one China and that Taiwan is a part of that. But how they resolve their differences is up to them. And when we reestablished official relations with China in 1979, Congress responded by coming out with the Taiwan Relations Act, which is law, which says there are certain obligations we will maintain to Taiwan. And we've maintained those today. So, as Michael Swain, our colleague here at the Carnegie Endowment, recently said, the One China policy is not a card on the table with which Donald Trump can use to try to get leverage. It is the table itself. It is the foundation for our engagement with the PRC. Now, we should look at the One China policy and see if it requires updating. And we should probably do more. The phone call, which you mentioned that Donald Trump had with Tsai Ing-wen, in and of itself is not a bad thing. He should have a conversation with the Taiwan president, I would argue. But we need to enhance and upgrade our relationship with Taiwan in a smart way and not in a way that's going to cause our friends in Taiwan harm. And if you do it with the lights blazing and in a provocative and a confrontational way with respect to China, that's only going to result in more pressure from the PRC on Taiwan. And so I think this is something we have to be very careful about. And I'm not sure that the administration has thought through this. And I'm not sure Donald Trump has had the benefit of his cabinet secretaries weighing in and the professionals who've worked on these issues for a long time.
Yeah, I guess that's the question, is does he understand how critical this is to China's leadership?
I think that what, and I'm guessing here, of course, because right. We're all trying to figure out what Donald Trump's intentions are. But he does fancy himself as a talented businessman and a good negotiator. And I think as a negotiator, he's talked about in his books the importance of unpredictability, keeping the other side off balance. And so I think that's what he's trying to do with the Chinese. I think what he's also trying to do is to sort of say, well, what's the most important thing to China? And that's Taiwan. And therefore, I'm going to use that as leverage. The problem is, Taiwan is an island with 23 million people. It's a democracy.
Right. It's not a real estate deal.
It is not a bargaining chip that he can use. And we ought to be engaging with the leadership in Taiwan, with the people of Taiwan, before the administration begins to use Taiwan as a bargaining chip. That, I think, frankly, is immoral. I think it probably goes against the Taiwan Relations Act. And it's not something that I would ever advocate that the administration do.
It's interesting on the kind of way in which this is being handled. I mean, as you say, I think rightly that his strategy or tactic is to try to off balance, keep people off balance. But it seems to me, and tell me if this is accurate, is that that was often the Chinese strategy with a new American president. I remember, you know, with Bush, when one of the Chinese fighter planes clipped the wing of an American plane very soon after President Bush came into power. Right. And, you know, who knows whether that was an intentional way to try to kind of unsettle the American president.
You know, keeping the Chinese off balance may not be a bad strategy. And I think it's worth thinking about. Unpredictability may be a good element in terms of pushing on the issues that we talked about early on, North Korea, trade and economics, greater market access with China, better business environment for our companies, and, you know, preventing the Chinese from undermining our interests in the South China Sea. Unpredictability, keeping them off balance, may be good. But one of the things that you need in order to strengthen your approach with China is to have allies and to be predictable with those allies. You can't be unpredictable with your foes and your competitors and with your allies. And I think that's where, you know, the phone call with the Australian Prime Minister was disturbing, because in order to have, you know, our approach to China starts with our approach to the region and having good, strong alliances where our alliance countries feel they can depend on us, that we're credible in terms of the things that we say, that our commitment to the Asia Pacific, in terms of our presence there, not only our security presence, but of course our trade and economics there. You know, I've said recently that Donald Trump has started out being very tough on China rhetorically through his tweets. But one could argue that, you know, walking away from the Trans-Pacific Partnership is given the Chinese a pretty big strategic victory early on, despite him talking so tough on the Chinese. You know, this Trans-Pacific Partnership was important to show American leadership in the Asia-Pacific that we're committed to the region in terms of trade and economics. And so I think, you know, the administration, I think, is going to need to sort of step back, regroup, once it gets its cabinet officials in place. I think the new Secretary of Defense and the new Secretary of State understand these issues, and I think that they need to begin to think more deeply about them and pull together a strategy that's tied to what are the long-term objectives of the U.S. and the region. How does China fit into that?
But, I mean, I guess there's one area where they might not get the chance or the luxury to do that because it could blow up at any moment, which is North Korea, right? And there does seem to be a fairly widespread perception, certainly within the Trump administration, but I think elsewhere, that China should be doing more to try to rein in Kim Jong-un. Is that your view? And does the Americans have any bargaining power there?
The North Korea issue, I think, has come to the foreground in terms of the most important security issue that we need to address in the region and potentially in the world. And the Chinese have been hearing this from their interlocutors in the United States over the last couple years, for sure. Even if Hillary Clinton was president today, I think we could expect a tougher approach with vis-a-vis China about North Korea. So it's not surprising that the Trump administration right now is doing a policy review. I think that it's important that we do as much as we can with China. Now, Donald Trump's argument is that they haven't been doing enough. And he's got, you know, he's probably right in that regard. Because in order, you know, Kim Jong-un has, over the last several years, you know, they're now on there, they've conducted 5 nuclear tests. He's really upped the ante in terms of the number of missile tests that they've done over the last year. This all contributes to the enhancing their capability in terms of putting a nuclear warhead on an intercontinental ballistic missile that could range the United States. This threat has dramatically increased, and the United States can't stand by and let this continue. So the United States will have to do something. And I think that through this policy review, they need to consider the China piece, and we will need an approach that includes deterrence, doing things in the region with our security partners that contributes to deterrence with North Korea. We'll have to continue with efforts like the missile defense that we've done with South Korea. But I also think that as we put more pressure on North Korea and do this, hopefully in collaboration with China, they will need to step up, I think, and do more. I think we also need to begin engaging North Korea. And as an effort to try to understand better what's happening and how we can make progress on this issue. This issue's become much more difficult than it was several years ago, because it appears that Kim Jong-un is not interested in the least in giving up his nuclear capability.
But you say engage North Korea? I mean, that's antithesis, isn't it, to most American policymakers?
I think that if it is a part of a larger strategy which involves tougher measures, putting more pressure on North Korea through, we have the sanctions that were agreed to in the spring. Pretty tough sanctions. We want to give those a chance to play out to see what happens. I think we can look at secondary sanctions. These are sanctions that will put pressure on Chinese companies, but I think as we go forward, we'll recognize that those are probably more important, and we'll need to enhance our deterrence efforts. And so if we have a strategy that's putting more pressure, I think the diplomatic piece will become important to do. We can't rely on the diplomatic piece by itself. That is not going to work in my mind. It has to be coupled with greater deterrence pressure and greater pressure through sanctions.
Let's talk about President Xi, because he's, you know, this is not in a vacuum, right? He has his own very pressing domestic issues to deal with, and he's got a very important party conference coming up later this year. In a way, it strikes me he's kind of analogous to Trump. I mean, in a way, he's putting, you know, America. I mean, Trump is putting America first.
Right.
Xi is about putting China first, isn't he?
Absolutely. You know, I often say that, you know, before Donald Trump had his slogan, "Make America Great Again," Xi Jinping had his slogan, "Make China Great Again." Right. And he's been riding on that slogan for the last 5 years since he was elevated to be the president of China and the secretary general of the Communist Party. So, you know, there's a rejuvenation of the Chinese nation underway in China. They're feeling more confident. They've got more influence in the world. They're more powerful. They are now the second largest world, you know, economy in the world, largest exporter. They're a, you know, a major economic entity in global markets. You know, they've started the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. They've got a majorly ambitious effort to connect China to Europe through Central Asia, called the One Belt, One Road. This is a very different China that we're looking at today. And President Xi Jinping is, and the leadership there, is in the early process of a political transition that will culminate in the 19th Party Congress in the fall of this year. It's a very sensitive and delicate time. On one hand, people say, well, Xi Jinping's going to need a stable environment to make sure that that leadership transition is successful, so he's not going to rock the boat and react to some of what Donald Trump is doing. On the other hand, he can also not appear weak. And if Donald Trump is appearing to bully China and the Chinese president does not stand up to that bullying, it could undermine his own efforts within this political transition. And so I think that...
Because there are people on the right of his party, as it were, who are arguing for a much more aggressive policy.
Yeah, he'll be criticized for not standing up to Donald Trump and the new administration. And he'll want to brandish some of his tough credentials among some of his political competitors. And so I think this makes it an even more delicate and sensitive time period. And I think it's why I think it's going to require the administration, as I said before, to really begin to think through what it wants to do in Asia. What are the goals? What is the long-term strategy? How does China fit into that? And then begin to implement. It appears to me as some of this has been not very well thought through, ill-conceived, and somewhat reckless.
But just to stay on President Xi for a moment, does he face any serious challenges to his power from this Congress?
You know, it's quite opaque in China. They don't have as open and a transparent process, as political system, as we do. He has undergone a very intense anti-corruption campaign, which has allowed him to a large extent to consolidate his political power. Many people say he's in quite a good position politically. Some people say he's not as strong in his political position as people think. Nevertheless, there's always intense jockeying the year up leading up to a party Congress. And it's always a very delicate time period. In fact, if you remember, before the 18th Party Congress, you saw Bo Xilai, who was a major contender for leadership positions in the standing committee, and he ran into all sorts of trouble and was ultimately purged from the system.
Basically.
So, you know, these are very sensitive and delicate times, and I think that the U.S.-China relationship will certainly play into what happens over the next year. But I think if it's misplayed from the United States, I think this will not be good for U.S. interests. I mean, at the end of the day, Tom, it's all about, in my mind, what's best for U.S. interests. How do we achieve objectives? Donald Trump has made a lot of promises in the context of the presidential campaign, and he's going to want to show that he's achieving those objectives. And so it's not about how provocative can we be with China? It's not about how confrontational can we be. It's not about what can we do to poke the eye, you know, poke China's eye. It's about what can we do to reset the relationship with China in a way that allows Donald Trump and the administration to achieve its objectives, right, whether that's on trade and economics, whether that's respect to North Korea, the strategic rivalry in the Asia-Pacific region.
But when you talk about a much more confident China, like you say, second largest economic power in the world, do you see that translating into China taking a much bigger role on the world stage? I mean, take somewhere like the Middle East, for instance. You know, America has been progressively withdrawing from the Middle East for the last decade. Do you think China wants to kind of get involved in that politically and be seen as the kind of global ringmaster?
It's a great question. And, you know, China has always been sort of a unique country on this spectrum between a developing nation and a major power. And I think you've seen China over the years really emphasize this notion that it's really a developing power. As Donald Trump and his administration begins to step back from some of the commitments to global architecture, whether it's, you know, global trade, whether it's the climate change agreement that was reached, whether it was the Iran nuclear agreement, I think China will try to take advantage of that and step forward and present itself as, you know, a responsible stakeholder, which is something we had encouraged, have encouraged China to do over the years. Some of that will be from a PR standpoint,
right.
Posturing. Right. And certainly we saw at Davos the speech by Xi Jinping where he talked about China being a responsible global economic power on the economic side and the importance of the global economic architecture and that China is committed because that's important to China. Of course, China relies on an international market with respect to its economy. On the security side, I would agree with you. They're not looking to replace the United States.
Right.
They're not stepping up on those. They're contributing more to the United Nations and in a multilateral organizations, they'll try to do more, you know, contributing financially and potentially more personnel. But in terms of, you know, enhancing their contributions to our efforts in the Middle East, I don't see that coming for a
while. They're not going to send a battle group anytime soon.
I don't see that anytime soon.
Right. And that's a very important thing to make, because I think a lot of people take that leap of logic, don't they? And they say, wow, second largest economic power, feeling very confident. Therefore, they must about to be, you know, emerge as a global strategic player. But you're saying that actually,
well,
it's important to understand the difference between China and the U.S.
It's absolutely right. We have a lot of these conversations at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing. And what we hear mostly from Chinese scholars is China's not ready for that. Mm. We don't have the capacity. And in many ways, they don't want to stick their neck out on the line. You know, they're still, even though they've moved away from this Deng Xiaoping concept of keeping a low profile internationally, this phrase Tao Guang Yang Hui, which was to keep a focus on the domestic development, to not overreach internationally because that'll take away from your efforts at home. They've moved away from that quite a bit, I mean, with the AIIB and the One Belt, One Road, but nevertheless, it's still part of their thinking. Mm-hmm. They're not looking to overstretch. They're not looking to take on a leadership role on security issues like the United States has. But I think that the new administration in the U.S. has to be careful. We have to keep in mind, for many, many years, we have been encouraging China to be that responsible stakeholder. Bob Zelik, when he was Deputy Secretary of State, gave a speech in 2005 at the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations encouraging China to be a responsible stakeholder, not to be a free rider in the world. And it's beginning to look as the Trump administration talks about pulling out of the climate change agreement, walking away from the Iran agreement, moving away from the global economic architecture. It's beginning to look like an ironic turn of the tables. That is it that China is going to have to remind the United States that it's important to be a responsible global stakeholder? I hope not, because I think the United States should play a leadership role in the world and we should not disengage from the world. American leadership is important.
That would be ironic, wouldn't it? Well, thank you, Paul. It's obviously going to be a fascinating few years and particularly few months in the run-up to this Congress. We'll be watching it closely and come back to you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.